It's going to be a history-making year at the U.S. Supreme Court. On the docket, two cases about gay marriage. This hour, a preview of those cases and others. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. My guests this hour, Todd Pettis and Song Richardson, two faculty members from the University of Iowa College of Law. They'll tell us about key cases before the nation's highest court this year, including the constitutionality of California's Prop 8, which bans same-sex marriage, and DOMA, the Defense of Marriage Act. We'll also talk about two major criminal cases on the docket that deal with the Fourth and Fifth Amendments. Discussion starts right after this news. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, it's going to be a history-making year at the U.S. Supreme Court. On the docket, we're going to talk about today some of the highlights, as many as we can get to, but for sure, two civil cases about same-sex marriage, also two major criminal cases on the docket, one dealing with the Fourth and the other with the Fifth Amendment. Maybe we'll get more than that, but we'll see. We'll preview those, analyze those, and others as time permits with my guests this hour. Todd Pettis is our civil expert on the civil cases, Associate Dean for the Faculty at the University of Iowa College of Law and the H. Blair and Joan V. White Chair in Civil Litigation. Todd Pettis, welcome to our program.
Thank you very much.
Also joining us in our Iowa City studio, Song Richardson, our criminal expert, Professor of Law at the University of Iowa College of Law, specializing in criminal law. Song, welcome to you.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
Todd, let's concentrate on the civil cases to begin with, if we may. The Supreme Court, we heard, I guess it was back in December, that they agreed to hear two cases this year pertaining to the constitutionality of same-sex marriage. One, Hollingsworth v. Perry, involving Proposition 8, we've heard of that in our news. The California Supreme Court declared same-sex couples had the right to marry, but then Proposition 8 came back a few years ago, a referendum, voting the people said they wanted to take that right away. The other case, the United States v. Windsor, another case pertaining to same-sex marriage, dealing with a deference of the Marriage Act, also known as DOMA, the Defense of Marriage Act. Let's get to those. Shall we start off with Hollingsworth v. Perry?
Sure.
Tell us the story of what's going on with this civil case.
Well, as you said, it has to do with the constitutionality of Prop 8. The story in California here really began in the year 2000 when, as the push for same-sex marriage nationally started to gain steam, voters in California decided to adopt by citizen initiative a statute saying that marriage was only proper between heterosexuals. 8 years later, 2008, the California Supreme Court found that that statute violated the California Constitution, which then provoked a very hot debate in California. And 6 months roughly after the Supreme Court had issued its ruling, voters decided to amend the California Constitution, and that's the Prop 8 that you referred to. One of the interesting things about this case is that once the lawsuit was filed, the California officials who had been sued agreed with the plaintiffs that Prop 8 was unconstitutional, and so they refused to defend the case.
Hmm.
That then leaves the question, who, if anyone's going to speak on behalf of Prop 8? And the five or so individuals who had led the charge for Prop 8, they're the ones who had gone, and that's the Hollingsworth and Hollingsworth versus Perry is Dennis Hollingsworth. He and four or five others, they're the ones who had paid the filing fee that was required to get Prop 8 on the ballot. They led the signature drive. So once they learned that the California officials were not going to defend the constitutionality of Prop 8, they went to the district court and asked for what in law we call permission to intervene, to become a party and gain the power to speak and help control the course of the litigation.
And the district court did what?
The district court allowed them in and allowed them to speak. And so through the course of the litigation from the district court and then to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, and even now in going to the United States Supreme Court, it's those people who initially launched the drive for Prop 8 who are speaking, in essence, on behalf of the state of California's law.
So tell us, what are the questions that the high court will be deciding in this case, the question or questions, narrowly seen?
Yeah. Well, there's two questions. One of them is, should these people, the Hollingsworth side of the V, should Dennis Hollingsworth and the four or five others, are they properly allowed in court? Do they have the power to speak in this way? It's very rare. And the other marriage case that we'll talk about shortly features exactly the same pattern, where President Obama and the Department of Justice are refusing to defend DOMA, and we have a different group of people there trying to come in.
But here
and defend
we have the
law.
State of California refusing to enforce a Prop 8.
Exactly. So the question is, when a law is adopted, as it was in California, by a citizen initiative, if the California government officials refuse to defend the legality of the law, can the people who launched the initiative drive come in and essentially speak on behalf of the state in the same way that a state attorney general would usually speak on behalf of a state? So that's a question that has to do with the power of the federal courts to even be deciding anything in this litigation. And it's possible that the Supreme Court will find that Hollingsworth is not a proper party. And if that's the case, the court won't say anything further. They won't say anything about same-sex marriage in that case. If they'd find that he is a proper party—
We get to the second question.
Then we get to the second question. Mm-hmm. The second question is, did California violate the federal constitution when they initially had same-sex marriage by virtue of the California Supreme Court ruling, and then it was taken away? And whether this is of any legal significance, we don't know yet. But one little quirk about this is when the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, the intermediate appellate court that's just below the Supreme Court, when they decided this case, they really zeroed in on that sequence of events, and they said, we're not going to decide today whether we think in general people have a federal constitutional right to same-sex marriage. We're deciding a narrower question, and what we're going to decide is, once the state has granted that right, as had happened in the California Supreme Court ruling, can they then take it away?
Mm-hmm.
And the Ninth Circuit found that they did not think that that was permissible. And so the state of the law there right now is the lower federal courts have found that this violates the Constitution, but everything is on hold.
Once a right is given by a state, it may not be rescinded. Is that essentially?
Yes, at least on these in this particular case having to do with marriage, because in California, even without marriage, same-sex couples have a very broad array of rights with respect to children, with respect to being able to visit one's partner in the hospital, where it's ordinarily limited to family members, that they have that right for insurance coverage. In a broad way, broad range of ways, same-sex couples have a lot of rights, but they're not allowed to marry. And the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals said that's not allowable.
Do you, after describing this case, Hollingsworth v. Perry, do you have a sense of which way it will go? Hard to predict. Of course, the great Nina Totenberg can't even predict them, so I'm putting you in those shoes too.
Yeah. You know, I think the first question about whether these people have, Hollingsworth and his colleagues, whether they have a power to speak, that's quite a difficult legal question. And as I read legal blogs and so forth, or people who write and teach in these areas, there's a real difference of opinion, and no one really wanting to stake their professional name, and so I'm not going to do it here today, on exactly how the court's going to rule on that question. That's a very difficult question because, for example, if they're allowed to come in and speak, how much power do they have? Can they negotiate a settlement on behalf of the state, or is that something that only the attorney general could do? So how much power to speak on behalf of the people of California has this small group of private citizens been given? That's complicated. And just a passing sentence or two in an earlier case, the Supreme Court has said in another case where something similar was happening, they said, this looks a little fishy, but we don't have to deal with it now.
Okay.
So now they'll have to deal with it. So what they say on that issue will be interesting. And then on the merits of the case, my guess is that if they get that far, I would be surprised if the Supreme Court focused, as the Ninth Circuit focused, on the sequence of events, saying you had the right, then took it away. I suspect the justices will move to the larger question and say, let's just talk about same-sex marriage in general.
Mm-hmm.
And is there such a constitutional right? And that undoubtedly is going to be a closely divided ruling.
Okay. Any fallout here potentially for Iowa specifically, being in the unique club of states that allow same-sex marriage?
The only thing that's at stake for Iowans, I would say, is if, since we have the right to same-sex marriage here, by virtue of an Iowa Supreme Court ruling, just as same-sex couples in California had it by virtue of a California Supreme Court ruling. What's at stake in Iowa is if the United States Supreme Court were to find that once granted, the right cannot be taken away, that would have powerful repercussions here in Iowa because it presumably would place some limits on Iowans' ability to amend the Constitution to take that right away.
Even some politicians asking for a referendum on this case here in Iowa, that even if that referendum went through and they won the referendum, it could not be taken away if this case was decided that way.
That's a strong possibility. Mm-hmm. We'd have to look at little differences between Iowa and California law, but that's a strong possibility, yes.
If you just joined us, Todd Pettis with us, Associate Dean for Faculty on the faculty of the University of Iowa College of Law, talking about highlights of the Supreme Court this year, and Song Richardson with us as well in our studio. We'll just a moment talk about some key criminal cases, but let's talk about the other case that has to do with same-sex marriage, please, Todd. This is the United States v. Windsor. Tell us about that, the case that deals with DOMA, the Defense of Marriage Act.
Well, this is an interesting story. Regardless of your views about same-sex marriage, I think anyone would have to agree that there's quite a story here in this case. And the story, quickly in a nutshell, is Edith Windsor, and I gather she goes by Edie. She's 83 years old now and not in good health. But in the early 1960s, when she lived in New York and she herself was in her low 30s, she met a woman named Thea Speier, and they hit it off, and there was a strong attraction between them. And in 1967, they got engaged because Thea Speier proposed to Edie Windsor, even though there was no prospect on the horizon at all of ever actually being able to get married.
Just between the two of them, maybe family members, who knows?
Sure, she proposed. And when she proposed, Thea did not give her a diamond engagement ring because Edie Windsor was a high-level computer programmer at IBM who did sensitive work sometimes for the government. And there was some concern that if she was walking around with a diamond ring, people would ask questions, you know, to whom are you engaged? And then she'd have to tell. So rather than do that, she gave her a diamond brooch instead, a pin. And they were engaged for 40 years. Now, during that time, Thea Speier acquired multiple sclerosis. She eventually became immobilized from the disease. And just as she was nearing, as they saw the end of her life coming, in 2007, so that's 40 years after they'd gotten engaged, they said before Thea Speier dies, she wants to get married. So they went to Canada. They went to Toronto, where marriage was possible, got married, came back, and in 2009, Thea Speier died. Now, here's where we get to the legal issue. When she died, she left her estate to Edie Windsor. And if the federal government recognized the marriage, then for purposes of the federal estate tax, a huge chunk of the estate would have gone directly to Edie Windsor. But because the federal government, through DOMA, which I can say something about here in a second.
Yeah, remind us what DOMA is, Defense
DOMA,
of Marriage.
DOMA is the Defense of Marriage Act. And so just as their relationship was progressing and in the story that I've just told, the federal government had passed in 1996 DOMA, the Defense of Marriage Act, which says a couple of different key things. Number one, it says that just because one state recognizes same-sex marriage, that does not mean that when a same-sex couple moves to another state, that other state has to recognize the marriage. And then the provision of DOMA that's at issue in this case is the federal government said, well, now for our purposes, for all federal laws where we deal with married people, it's only marriage between a man and a woman. Okay? Mm-hmm. So when Thea Speier dies and leaves a pretty substantial estate, there's about $360,000 that if the federal government recognized the marriage would have gone straight to Edie Windsor.
Not as tax to the government.
And because the federal government does not recognize same-sex marriage by virtue of DOMA, the federal government said you owe us $360,000. So the lawsuit is about the proper ownership of that $360,000. Is it the United States government or is it Edie Windsor? And legally, the way it's framed is, does DOMA, that provision where the federal government says we're not going to recognize same-sex marriage, does that violate the Constitution?
And on its merits, how do you see this one going?
Well, again, here, there's a question about whether we'll ever get to the merits because, as I mentioned a few moments ago, President Obama and the Attorney General refused to defend the law. They agree with Edie Windsor that DOMA is unconstitutional. And so a group of leaders from the House of Representatives, three Republicans. It's a little group that has five members, two of them Democrats, but the two Democrats voted not to go along with this. So the three members of this group called BLAG, it's the BLAG, the Bipartisan Leadership Advisory Group, they moved to intervene just as the Citizen Initiative people in the California case moved to intervene. They said, we want to come in and we want to defend the law.
We want to defend DOMA, make sure it's carried out.
Yeah, exactly. We're here to vindicate DOMA because we think it's a constitutional law.
Mm-hmm.
And so one of the issues for the Supreme Court in this case will be, does this group of John Boehner and Eric Cantor and one others, do they have what we in the law call standing? Are they properly in front of us in the court? And if they're not, then we can't hear the case. We won't say anything about the merits. If they decide that they are proper parties in the case and do have the authority to speak on behalf of the law's constitutionality, then they'll get to the merits. And I, among people who study in this area, I would say that a majority, I don't know how large of a majority, but at least a slim majority think that there's a greater likelihood that that provision of DOMA will be struck down.
So the implications potentially for Iowans, especially same-sex couples married in Iowa, is clearly that when you travel outside the state, you would either be recognized or not be recognized.
Yeah. Well, there's two provisions of DOMA. One thing that's at stake for same-sex couples who are married in Iowa right now is currently the federal government does not recognize them for purposes of federal law. And there's apparently more than 1,000 federal laws where this becomes an issue: insurance benefits, housing benefits, food stamp coverage, how we define a household, tax purposes, all kinds of laws where right now the federal government says to same-sex couples in Iowa, we don't recognize you as a married couple. And if the court declares this provision of DOMA unconstitutional, that will change immediately. The other provision of DOMA is the one that says if you move to another state, is that state forced to recognize your marriage? And even though that issue may be influenced by what the court says in this case, that's not actually what the court's being asked to decide right now.
In some of my reading for this show, I see that advocates of gay marriage say that this is they call it the civil rights issue of this generation. Wouldn't be characterized as civil rights by all sides, I assume.
Yeah, well, kind of at two levels. One, at the level of just same-sex marriage in general. That's certainly a big issue, regardless of the label one wants to put it under. And then the question of, well, are states going to be left free to each make that choice for themselves, or are we going to declare a uniform national law? And both of those questions are at stake in these two cases we've talked about.
I guess another way to put it is, from a legal perspective, we hear these cases being compared to civil rights. Of course, the civil rights in the 1960s. To what extent legally can they be compared with what happened in the 1960s?
Well, when you look at the 1960s and race, and then 60s and 70s discrimination against women, those had to do with laws singling out people based on certain traits and withholding from them certain benefits that those who did not have those traits were able to enjoy. And so in that sense, when we talk about same-sex marriage, it belongs in that category. The law is singling people out because of their sexual orientation or their sexual preferences and saying we're withholding certain benefits. Of course, to say that it's a civil rights case is not to say how it ought to be decided. But, you know, marriage is a civil right, at least for heterosexuals. Heterosexuals like myself at least think of it that way.
Mm-hmm.
One can readily understand how same-sex couples would look at this and say, as you put it, this is the huge civil rights issue that we face today.
Can one say between these two cases, United States v. Windsor having to do with DOMA or Hollingsworth v. Perry having to do with a Prop 8 in California, which of these is bigger, has greater implications for the nation at large?
No, it's hard to say because the answer in one doesn't necessarily dictate the answer in the other. And so they both have to I suppose Hollingsworth versus Perry may be a little larger. If the Supreme Court were to rule in one of these cases that you absolutely have a federal constitutional right to marry someone of the same sex, it would be the California case where they said it. And you know, I don't know that it's likely the court will get as far as that. But if they did get that far, then that would be the larger of the two, because then when we come to the Windsor case, which says, you know, the federal government's not going to recognize same-sex marriage. Well, we've now answered that question and said the federal government must.
Mm-hmm. I guess I'm saying, will we remember either Hollingsworth or Windsor in the same way we do Brown v. Board of Education?
If they get to the merits of the issue, quite possibly. Remember that in both of those cases, we've got an argument about what to do about the fact that the California government leaders and, in the Windsor case, the president, the people who traditionally defend the constitutionality of laws are refusing to speak. And so in both those cases, the court first has to get past the question, do we even have a case in front of us where we have the power to get involved? If they decide that they don't have the power to get involved, then we're going to forget about these cases quite quickly, and we're going to move on to another same-sex marriage case before too long, where that question's not raised, and so the court can very easily get straight to the merits of the question.
Todd Pettis is with the University of Iowa, on the faculty at the University of Iowa College of Law. Song Richardson with us as well. And Song Richardson, we want to get to a couple of key criminal cases before the high court in just a moment. We'll take a break in just a moment, but maybe just enough time to mention that we heard in the news that Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas spoke for the first time in 7 years. The court transcript only records his words, these words, "Well, he did not," quote, followed by Justice Scalia saying, "Well, I refute that, Justice Thomas." So somewhat hard to decipher, apparently, though Justice Thomas making some joke about Yale Law School, the best as we can understand. Before we have to go to break, we don't have too long on this. Maybe we can talk about it after the break, too. Song Richardson, is not speaking before the court a requirement of a U.S. Supreme Court? Some would think, of course.
Well, one would think that, of course, as a Supreme Court justice, you would have something to say. But if we think about the amount of media attention that Justice Thomas has gotten for speaking for the first time since he's been on the bench, it's quite powerful. It's quite powerful, perhaps, to
not
speak.
There was a time when he spoke from the bench. 10 years ago or something like that, and then ceased to do it.
But it was so long ago that people don't tend to remember that, right? So what I find interesting here is that when he does speak, he speaks in, one might say, code. So now we're all intrigued about what it is that he meant when he spoke to Justice Scalia. And I was at the court watching an argument last year. And what was interesting to me is that I saw Justice Thomas and Justice Scalia passing notes to each other. So there's some relationship there. And I'm intrigued about what they were talking about because I'm a Yale Law School graduate myself,
as is
Justice Thomas. So I'm very curious about what he was saying about the attorneys.
Maybe you got the joke. Maybe you felt slighted by the joke. I'm not sure. You don't know.
I can't tell the secret.
Okay. We will continue with our discussion. So glad to have Song Richardson with us, professor of law at the University of Iowa College of Law, specializing in criminal law. On the civil side, we've been listening to Todd Pettis, also at the College of Law. And when we come back, we'll concentrate with Song Richardson on the criminal cases, one dealing with the Fourth Amendment and one dealing with the Fifth Amendment. What is that phrase? I plead the fifth? I plead the fifth. Song is not going to plead the fifth when we return. We will learn about these two cases before the U.S. Supreme Court when we come back. If you have a question or a comment, 1-866-780-9100, River to River at iowapublicradio.org. Back with more of River to River in just a moment. This is Iowa Public Radio News. So good to have you with us on this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This hour, fascinating to talk about some of the cases that the U.S. Supreme Court has chosen to take on in 2013, and our guests doing it, two faculty members at the University of Iowa College of Law, Todd Pettis and Song Richardson, one in the civil corner talking about the civil cases, and primarily in the first half hour talking about cases having to do with same-sex marriage to be decided. Song Richardson in the criminal corner to talk about a couple of cases, one dealing with the Fourth and then the Fifth Amendment. Before we get to that, let's finish up a little bit on our discussion of Clarence Thomas making the news by speaking for the first time in court, during court, in nearly 7 years. Not much that he had to say, some sort of joke about Yale Law School. But I wanted to finish up here by asking, what do we know about why Justice Thomas doesn't choose to speak before the court, Todd Pettis?
Well, as Song said just before the break, it's been a number of years since he has spoken, and so he's been asked many times to give an account of why. And several years ago, I can't remember when exactly, he gave an explanation, which is not a bad explanation. He said, you know, when attorneys come before us, they often get a sentence out of their mouth, and then we start hitting them with questions. And usually that lasts for half an hour. Each attorney is usually given 30 minutes to talk. And he said, you know, I don't like having a battle with my colleagues on the court, just trying to get in a word edgewise. I don't think it's very polite or productive for the attorney to be interrupting them all the time. We ought to be able to at least get them a paragraph or two out of their mouths from time to time.
Right.
And so I just don't want to participate in this big show. And it's not as if he's disengaged, as Song said. He's quite engaged when you sit in the courtroom. He's I can't recall right now whether he's currently sitting next to Breyer because they changed their seating arrangement from time to time, but he's constantly either writing notes and handing them to court staff for them to run and grab some case and bring to him, or he's whispering to the person sitting next to him. So he's engaged in what's going on, but he just doesn't want to play this game of really trying to get the question out before the next justice speaks.
At first glance, one would think a silent justice was less powerful, but is that the case?
He has 1/9 of the court's power, just like they all do.
Okay. Let's turn to our criminal cases that we've selected, getting to, first of all, this case that involves the Fourth Amendment. It's called Maryland v. King, Song Richardson, and deals, I understand, with DNA privacy. The Fourth Amendment makes it illegal to search an area or a person or see something without a warrant.
Correct.
In broad terms. Tell us about this case.
So let me tell you a little bit about Mr. King. So, and because this case will be a pivotal DNA privacy case with broad implications, I think, for most of us. So Mr. King was arrested on a number of felony assault charges, and felonies are the most serious types of crimes. So he was arrested on felony assault charges, and there was a law in Maryland that said if you are arrested but not convicted yet, simply arrested on suspicion of committing a crime, the police are mandated, they're required to take a sample of your DNA using what they call a buccal swab, so swabbing your cheek. People may have seen this on Law and Order or some other crime shows. So they took his DNA, they did a profile of his DNA, and they uploaded it onto state and national criminal databases simply as a result of his arrest. Then they ran his DNA, which they had taken without a warrant. They ran his DNA within the criminal database to try to solve open cases or cold cases, and they got a hit. And when they were running his DNA, they had no suspicion that he had committed any other crime. They were just going on a fishing expedition, and they found that his DNA matched the DNA taken from a rape victim a few years earlier. So once they got that hit, they obtained a warrant. They took another swab from Mr. King, and they got a match. They got a hit again. And so they prosecuted him for the rape. And the prosecution and his ultimate conviction was based solely on the DNA sample that they had received from him when they arrested him. And so the issue here is – and this is what implicates all of us, right? When should the government – be able to take our DNA without a warrant, and our DNA, of course, is our genetic blueprint. It has all sorts of private information. When should they be able to take that DNA without a warrant and load it up onto a criminal database and then go fishing to solve unsolved crimes without any suspicion? That's the issue here. Now, if you've been convicted of a crime, most states allow your DNA to be taken from you.
But if we're in Maryland's case, they're going to be arguing that this is very similar to a photo or a fingerprint, except a lot more information, right?
And that is exactly what they're arguing. And they say we can take fingerprints without suspicion, without a warrant. It's part of our booking process. But the other side is saying it's not like a fingerprint because your fingerprint can only tell us your identity in the best of cases. Your DNA tells us so much more than your identity. It can give us your family history, for example.
But in this case, was the DNA used for more than the identity, the purpose of identity?
It was. It was used to try to solve unsolved crimes.
But the same way we might look through an album of photos of people with criminal backgrounds looking for to solve a cold case or whatever. Would it not be? I'm just sorry.
Yes.
You know, the DNA in this case, was it used for more than a very exceptional identity process?
Right. No,
they
used it just to solve open crimes that had DNA uploaded into the databases.
Okay. What's your feeling on how the high court will look at this and decide this?
Well, that's an interesting question for me and a difficult one, because I think with this particular case, Justice Alito, ironically, may be the one to watch. And I say ironically because he's not necessarily a friend to criminal defendants. But there was a recent case, the Jones case, decided last year dealing with GPS technology and whether or not the police had to get a warrant before they put a bug or a wire on your car. And Justice Alito expressed some squeamishness about the ability of technology to invade our privacy. It's the technology that he was worried about.
Mm-hmm. And the other possible uses for DNA?
DNA, they could find – well, I'll tell you what they're doing with some of this DNA, right? They can start to investigate your family members based on your DNA. And what I mean by that is if they put your profile up online and let's say, Ben, that your profile's in there,
okay,
but it doesn't quite match the DNA from a crime scene, but it's close.
But they know it's a family member?
That's what they think. So they start doing familial searches and they start investigating your family members to see whether or not they may have committed the crime.
And then all of a sudden we could get scared and think we're in a Tom Cruise film and get convicted before we before we commit a crime.
Right. And that's what I think Justice Alito may be somewhat concerned about, right? The advance of DNA and the ways in which it can invade our privacy. Health information, health insurance, right? They can tell sometimes whether or not you have a certain predisposition for certain health problems.
What for you would be, let me put it this way, what would be a surprising finding, a decision by the court in this case?
A surprising finding would be a unanimous court saying that what the police did, what the state of Maryland's law does is unconstitutional. That would be a surprising ruling.
So they're going to split it up somehow.
They may. That would be my prediction.
Maybe say that DNA may only be used for identification up to a certain point.
After a conviction.
After a conviction and limit it to an individual and not have it fan out to
family. To family members. I don't even know if they'll reach the family member issue. But it would be surprising, though, to me for them to ban this practice completely. I think it will be a fractured decision, but I'm not going to predict which way it will go.
What a fascinating case. Have we mentioned all the fascinating facets before we move on to the other case?
I think we have, yes.
Very good. Let's move on to the other case in order of amendments, I guess, the Fifth Amendment case, Salinas v. Texas. Just to remind our listeners, if you just joined us, Song Richardson with us of the University of Iowa College of Law on the faculty, Todd Pettis with us, also of the University of Iowa College of Law, and we're looking at the U.S. Supreme Court's some of the cases. There's so many of them. We could fill several hours talking about highlights in the 2013 on their docket at the U.S. Supreme Court. But we've chosen just a few from the criminal side in this case. In the first half hour, we looked at two civil cases. Let's talk about Salinas v. Texas, dealing with the Fifth Amendment. Among other things, the Fifth Amendment protects us from incriminating ourselves specifically. In this case, I have an understanding a failure to answer a police officer's question before an arrest may be used against a defendant at a trial. Tell us what's going on here.
Yes, and this really has implications for all of us. So Mr. Salinas was a person of interest in a double murder. So the police went to question him, and they didn't arrest him. And so he answers their questions for about an hour. And then they ask him, listen, Mr. Salinas, we recovered some shotgun shells at the scene of the crime. Will the shotgun that we took from your home, will that match the shotgun shells? After being asked that question, Mr. Salinas decided not to answer. 15 years later, they bring him to trial on this double homicide. He was tried once and the jury hung. So he was tried a second time, and this time the prosecutor commented on his silence before he was arrested. So the prosecutor said at trial, listen, jury, you should infer guilt because an innocent person would have answered this question.
Mm-hmm.
And after that, and the prosecution made a big deal of that, and Mr. Salinas was convicted in this particular case. So the question is, do you have a right to remain silent before you're arrested? And if you do have that right, then the prosecution cannot comment on your silence prior to an arrest and before your Miranda warnings. So that's what's at issue here.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So if we have a ruling in favor of Texas, would it be in the best interest for a person to say, arrest me?
Ironically, yes.
But,
right? Because otherwise.
Because otherwise you're not protected.
Exactly. And for the police, if I'm an officer, what am I going to do? I'm not going to arrest you, right? I'm going to get all sorts of questions until you don't answer, and then we can
use
it. So
you have these two counterintuitive things going on.
Exactly.
If the case would rule in this case. So what do you think is going to happen here? Do you have any sense of that?
I don't, because the law is so fractured. And it's interesting because the Supreme Court has shown great interest recently in the Fifth Amendment and in Miranda, our Miranda rights. And at this point, the lower federal courts all over the place. In Iowa, though, what's interesting in Iowa, the Eighth Circuit, which covers Iowa, has already held that the prosecution can comment on your right to remain silent after you've been arrested, but before Miranda. And that's shocking, right? Because so I'm not sure what the Supreme Court's going to do here, but it will have implications across the country for police database behavior.
Okay, we're good. We'll watch that. And these decisions, tell us a little bit about the rhythm of the U.S. Supreme Court, because they hear the cases. Typically, how long is each case, Todd, argued before the court? How much does that vary?
The length of time of the argument or how long we have to wait for a ruling?
Well, first of all, the length of the argument, because I know our court case about the health care law was an extremely long one.
Yeah, the court decided to take several days, so we had a week of court theater for the healthcare case, but that's very rare. It's almost always 1 hour per case. Every now and then it's 2 hours for a case. But I'm sure – I haven't looked, but I'm sure that all the mm-hmm. cases we've talked about today, they get 1 hour, half an hour for each side. Mm-hmm. They hear two or three cases a day, not every day, but on the days they're going to hear cases, they usually hear them in groups of three. They start the first Monday in October. And then they kind of hear cases through the following spring, and they wrap up by the end of June. And cases that are very divisive take longer to write because one side, you know, the majority is going to write its opinion, and then the other justices who disagree, they need time to write something that responds. Opinions can come down as soon as a month or so after oral argument. Sometimes it takes many months.
One thing that's always fascinated me that is a big question that perhaps one of you can answer is the U.S. Supreme Court, we rarely, if ever, hear what the decision will be before the court wants us to know what that decision will be. Is that a fair statement? Or do some insiders really know it and it's not making it to whatever media I listen to or watch? I'm just comparing it to, say, Congress or the White House.
Mm-hmm.
Constant leaks all the time, many of them intentional with purpose.
Sometimes you can get a sense from the argument itself, from the questions that the justices ask. And so everyone likes to speculate after listening to an argument how the decision is going to go, which justice is going to be assigned to write the majority opinion. So there's a lot of speculation based on what we hear in public.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but you're right. They run a very tight ship.
Because they have an army of people working for them.
Yeah, well, a very small army, but it's true they have several. Each justice has three or four clerks, recent law graduates, very, very smart people. And so all of the clerks know the staff. And so within the court, sure, I'll make up a number. You know, there's maybe 50 people in the building who know how a case is going to come out. But, you know, there's a very strong tradition of secrecy, and there's, I think, a very powerful sense of loyalty between the justices and their clerks that while they're there working in that building together, it's a very intense experience and it's a very enclosed experience. And, once a clerk leaves, sometimes they talk to the press about what the real inside story was. So even that's rare. And when it happens, other people who their predecessors, they all kind of come down on him and say, how dare you break our code?
Okay. We have a little bit of time left. It's good that we do, too, because I'd like to go to each of you and perhaps have you bring out another case, tell us a little bit about it, at least, that you feel is of a special interest on the Supreme Court's docket. If we could swing from the criminal side over to Utah to have us tell us about another civil case that they're hearing.
One of them is called Fisher versus University of Texas. I mention that because I'm sitting in a college town as I speak. And the issue there is how much can a public university do to increase the racial diversity of its entering class? It involves the University of Texas. And
tell us the story behind this one.
Well, at the University of Texas, some time ago, they adopted a policy where if you graduate within the top 10% of your Texas high school, you're automatically offered a seat in the incoming undergraduate class at the University of Texas. And they fill about, it varies from year to year, but they fill about 75% of their class that way. And because they do it that way, they bring in pretty substantial racial diversity because, of course, as you go from neighborhood to neighborhood, high school to high school, you have a lot of high schools where Hispanics are dominant. So they get quite a bit of racial diversity that way. But the University of Texas has decided, and this is where the case comes, that for that remaining 25% of their class or so, they're going to include race among a number of other factors in deciding whether someone should be admitted. And the issue in a nutshell in front of the court is, are we going to place any limits on what a university can do to increase its racial diversity, even at a school like Texas where they already have quite a bit of diversity through its top 10% program? Can they still press beyond that and say, we want diversity in every classroom?
So clearly implications for any learning institution in the U.S., including the University of Iowa, where you teach.
Sure. In terms of what a school's options are if they choose to make racial diversity a priority.
Song Richardson, with a couple minutes left, what would you like to bring out in terms of another criminal case that you're looking at with interest?
Well, there's one criminal case that may affect us because the state of Missouri, it's Missouri v. McNeely, the state of Missouri is asking that the Supreme Court allow for a categorical rule that whenever police stop you on suspicion of a DUI, they can take your blood without a warrant and without consent. And so there are some states, for example, where the police will stop someone on suspicion of a DUI and the police officer, him or herself, will pull out a syringe and get some of your blood.
Is that driving under the influence?
Yes. Oh, I'm sorry. Yes.
Yeah, does that happen here in Iowa, for instance?
Iowa doesn't have a law that allows a categorical rule to allow the police to do this. But they might, right? If the Supreme Court rules that officers have the right to do this and it doesn't violate your Fourth Amendment rights, then why wouldn't officers do that? Because the best evidence that you're driving while intoxicated comes from your blood.
Right. And so the breathalyzers fit into this case at all?
Breathalyzers do, but breathalyzers are you can impeach a breathalyzer versus a blood test. So the blood test is
meaning
the gold standard.
You can make it go haywire somehow.
Exactly. You can argue that the machine isn't accurate.
I see.
For example,
blood is blood, and
if they have a right to take it from you, then that's it, right?
What would you see as implications here based on the court's decision?
Well, I don't think the court is going to allow a categorical rule. I think they're going to require officers to seek a warrant before taking your blood unless they can't get a warrant within, let's say, a half hour because alcohol dissipates in your blood. So I don't think the Supreme Court is going to go so far as to say officers have a right to decide for themselves when to take your bodily substances.
I wonder, you're both at the University of Iowa College of Law. We're talking about the U.S. Supreme Court. I wonder if there you have any information about how Iowa law graduates do in terms of reaching appellate courts, district courts, even serving the high court in some way. Any knowledge of that? Any
becoming judges?
Sure.
A fair number. I don't have the most recent percentages in my mind right now, but we always have at least a handful of students go off and serve as clerks for judges. The Iowa Supreme Court, the Iowa Court of Appeals, federal courts, and they work very closely helping judges and justices research the cases that come before them, often helping draft opinions. It's a fabulous experience. We're always very proud of our students who go off and do that. Mm-hmm. And I don't know how many of our alums are serving as judges. I know we have some.
Lots of worries in recent years about the politicization of courts in Iowa and the high court here. Is that reflected also in your teaching at the University of Iowa College of Law? Has that entered into discussion more than in past years?
I don't think so. The faculty at any good law school, including Iowa, are really doing their best to train their students, regardless of what their personal ideologies might be, to really become as sharp as they can and go do whatever they want with their law degrees. And so while debates about, the Iowa Supreme Court and the ouster of justices, while we talk about those sayings or host an event to talk about those things, day to day in the classroom, we're working as hard as we can to get our students, conservative, liberals, and all everyone in between, just to be able to think very, very clearly and learn how to articulate their own positions as powerfully as they can, and we're proud of doing it.
Todd Pettis, Associate Dean for Faculty and the H. Blair and Joan V. White Chair in Civil Litigation, along with Song Richardson, Professor of Law at the College of Law. You have been really wonderful in making very difficult material accessible to me and I assume a lot of other listeners. Thank you very much. We'd love to have you back. Perhaps we can check back with you in June when these decisions are handed out and have further explanation if you'd be open for that.
It's a lot of fun to be here. Thanks for asking both.
It was great. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Song. Thank you, Todd. River to River is produced by Sarah Bowden and Emily Woodbury. Production assistance today from Allison Sullivan. Technical support from Dennis Reese. The executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.